session number 32969, Reel 1.
No?
Yeah. John Fraser, Reel 1.
John, can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in Nairobi in Kenya. My father was in the colonial service on administration on the railway system in Korea, in Kenya, and I was born on the 7th of January 1926. My education in Kenya was started, and my parents were going to leave me there when they went back to England. We used to go back to England about every 3 years for 3 months holiday. But after 9 years, my father packed in the job with the colonial service and decided to come back to England. So my education was cut short in Kenya, and I came back to England. In England, my parents acquired a restaurant in the Strand, and I went to St. Martin's in the Field School. I used to sing in the choir there. In fact, I spoilt their Christmas play by tripping up the steps. We were in London for quite a long while, but my parents moved around quite a bit. After the restaurant episode, he did other jobs and we moved around. I went to about, half a dozen or more different schools, so my education was badly interrupted. We ended up in Wembley during the war, the first part of the war. So we were outside the Blitz area of London, but we used to sort of see all the effects of the Blitz, and in fact Wembley had quite a few bombs. I always refused to go into the shelter at nights, because basically the bombing in Wembley wasn't all that mad. We had a few incendiaries in the garden and things like that, but there was nothing serious. It was quite an exciting period. Ever since the age of about 14, I wanted to fly.
How had that interest started? How had your interest in flying started?
As I say, as a young lad, I always wanted to fly, make lots of model aircraft and things like that. So my parents encouraged me quite a bit. So when I left school at about 16 and a half. I went to a technical college, qualified and building construction mainly. I went to, my first job was an apprentice quantity surveyor. And at that time, of course, the only building going on was airfields. And I was put on airfield construction in Lincolnshire, which is very interesting. Now, during that time, as I came up to 17 and a half, I realised I was going to be called up. So I volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm.
Why the Fleet Air Arm?
Because I wanted to fly, but I wanted to fly a more challenging career. I didn't want to land on land, I wanted to land on the ship. And I felt that the Fleet Air Arm was much more specialist and a little bit higher quality than the RAF. So I went and volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm. At 17 and a half, they took me to Cambridge University for selection tests, which included maths and physical tests, coordination, hands, eye, foot. They were quite punishing, but they accepted me. I passed those tests and they accepted me. So I then hung on to wait for my papers to arrive at the age of 18. During that time, I was called up as a Bevin boy, which of course I immediately sent the papers back and said, I'm already accepted in the Fleet Air Arm. Thank goodness for that. Otherwise, I'd have been in a coal mine for the rest of the bloody war. That happened. I entered the Fleet Air Arm in March 1944 at Gosport, as everyone did in those days. Did your three-month square bashing and all the tests that go with it.
Is that purely induction into naval life rather than flying?
Yes, I think so. I think what they did at Gosport was to instill discipline, first and foremost. You realised that you had to bear up with the routine, and the routine was made by the boss. It was good for the soul, good for the body as well. I mean, we used to go swimming in the sea. It was March. We used to go swimming in the sea at 6 o'clock in the morning, yeah, and then run 3 miles, then have breakfast, that sort of thing. Anyway, at 18, you, good for that. Towards the end of 94, a long wait because of delays with shipping and courses, short courses doing. Anyway, I finally got out to Canada, I think, in about October 1944.
Did you have a choice where you went?
The split between what type of aircraft you flew and what type of pilot you were, i.e. observer, pilot or whatever, was made much later on. You're not at those stages. What they did is when you got to Canada and you did your flying training, as soon as you go solo after a few hours and your instructors assess your flight ability, and that's a screen, and a lot of people failed at that stage and passed. We had 45 of us entered Canada on the course. 6 of us came out with wings. So the screening was quite tough.
What type of aircraft were you learning initially?
In Canada, that was the PT-26 Cornell, a two-seater open cockpit. And the temperatures in Canada, and those were minus 40. It was cold, very cold. To give you an idea of the temperature, we used to take it in turns. We used to stand out at night, after midnight, with a hose and water the ice skating rink. And of course it froze during the night and it stayed frozen for the rest of the winter. So we used to make our own ice skating rink purely on outside temperatures. You had to cover your ears and your fingers, otherwise you got frostbite that bad.
And were you flying from a snowbound runway?
Yeah, ordinary airfield, but when the snow, you see, you have in Canada, you have about 6 or 7 foot of snow total during the winter. What they did for flying is that they steamrolled the runways, the snow, and compacted the snow. So the aircraft had wheels, but they also had skis on them, so the wheels below the skis. So if it was dry enough, the wheels took over. If the wheels were soft, too soft, the wheels went into the ground and you skied. So the aircraft was, we flied throughout the winter, it wasn't bad. You couldn't fly in the bad weather, but it was okay, it wasn't bad.
What was the initial sequence of instruction prior to soloing that you did?
What was the
sequence of instruction that you had?
Well, it's quite normal. They teach you the basics of aeronautics, run the basics of how an aircraft gets lift and how you manipulate an aircraft, turning, gliding, climbing and descent. And then they go through the process of approaching and landing. Before you go solo, of course, they do very long processes on engine failure, how you cope with engine failure, etc. Quite interesting, and of course, testing, hence the cut-off of people who didn't make it.
What was the main reason for their failure most of the time?
Not being able to go solo, not being able to pass exams. There are exams at every stage. Those exams were written exams, theory exams, not practical. So that you were studying all the time, meteorology and all the other subjects that go with aviation. And so there was quite a few things that you could fail at. and you had to be very careful. You had to really make sure that you got on. Fortunately, in Canada in those days, it was the prohibition area where you couldn't get alcohol. You were allowed, I think, one bottle of spirits a month, something like that, the rationing, which, of course, the sort of drinking that goes on today wasn't possible. In the services, it would have been, you would have had more failures if today's drinking was applicable then. You really would.
I take it that you took to flying.
Yeah, I got my wings in July 45, passed all my exams, I got my wings, and I was when you're training, you're a leading seaman, Killick badge. When you pass get your wings, you go up to a petty officer. So you end up as a petty officer. When you came back to England from Boston, into Liverpool. When you got your wings, you went up to, of all places, Whitehaven, where the shooting was last week. There you sat at an Admiralty board to decide whether you had a commission or not. And your age depended on whether you were a sub-lieutenant or a midshipman. If you passed the commissioning board. So you got your commission there. I passed as a sub-lieutenant and then started doing the courses, all sorts of courses that were filling at the end of the war, at the end of the European war, and still thinking about the Pacific War.
What had you learnt on after the Cornell? What was your was there a second aircraft that you went on to when you were flying in Canada that you trained on?
Sorry?
Was there a second aircraft that you trained on in Canada?
Canada, you train on two aircraft. The PT-26 Cornell, which is a single-wing two-seater, open two-seater, which is basically a very elementary aircraft with elementary instruments. Said. You then passed on to the Harvard. The Harvard was a much more complex aircraft, much more like a real fighter, and is still in use today, actually, the Harvard. Quite an interesting aircraft to fly. You could do a lot more aerobatics in the Harvard, and you could spin it and things like that. And you did all your gunnery training in the Harvard. There was elementary training in those days, but it was gunnery training. Then when you get back to England, of course, you had to convert to other types of aircraft. And the first type I converted to, of course, was the Seafire, which was the operational aircraft in those days. But as I say, things then, because the Pacific War ended, courses were designed to waste time. I spent a lot of time on leave, but I did a lot of courses. And some of those courses were very useful in later life. For example, I did a twin course with the RAF, flew twin engines. The Oxford, Airspeed Oxford, was the aircraft they used in those days. And also the Anson, I flew those too. So having done those sort of courses, I've got a lot of experience on different types of aircraft and, of course, flying as well. I then they decided that I wanted to use us more economically, so I was sent to a ferry pool, which again was most interesting because you ferried aircraft all around England. A ferry pool was at Crail, where there was a Royal Naval Air Station, and I used to ferry all sorts of aircraft all over the place.
What were your impressions of the Seafire?
What?
Of the Seafire. What did you think of the Seafire?
Seafire was a beautiful aircraft. It's like the Spitfire. It was, it has a reputation. It's a beauty to fly. It's not all that it's not easy to deck land. It's one of the worst aircraft in the world to deck land because it was never made for deck landing. Its undercarriage was too narrow. Three tail wheel instead of tricycle undercarriage. And its oleos were not meant for the descent rate that you get on a carrier, and therefore they had lots of accidents. No, the seafire was the seafire was not a deck landing aircraft, and they realised that, I think, and started buying American, of course.
Did you have an opportunity to fly some of the American types at the ferry pool?
I never actually flew an American aircraft, but I did fly from American carriers. We used to do some exchange flying, and I've flown from American carriers both in Korea and in the Atlantic when we used to coordinate with exercises.
What type of aircraft were you flying at the ferry pool?
In the ferry pool, I flew Harvards, Tiger Moths, Ansons, Oxfords, Martinets, Barracudas. Barracudas. Hang on. Harvards, Barracudas, Sea Otters, Martinets, Sea Fires, Firefly I flew later on, Furies I flew later on, Vampires I flew later on, Venom I flew later on, Seahawk, Oxford, Anson, Dominies, that's the other one I did a lot on, Mosquitoes, and Sea Hornets.
Was it good experience being able to fly a number of different types of aircraft?
Oh, I think it makes you a more rounded aviator, definitely. Gives you experience on it, not too dissimilar from driving different kinds of car, but of course much more complex. Before you fly a new aircraft, towards the end in our days, you had to do a cockpit check blindfolded so that you knew where the dials and switches were. And if you pass that, then you read the pilot's notes about handling and about fuel management and that sort of engine management. Once you've done all that, then you fly another aircraft. But then when I finished my operational training, I went to one of the Navy's best squadrons, 801, flying Sea Hornets.
What had happened with your status? Had you decided to stay in the Fleet Air Arm at the end of the war? Because would it be that when you volunteered, would it be for war service?
Yeah.
So had you made the decision at that stage then to stay on and take a...
Well, what happened is that before I joined an operational squadron, I was sent to Malta for 2 years. And I flew in what they called a Fleet Requirements Unit in Malta, 728. Now, that unit provided aviation for all the requirements in the Mediterranean. Mail collection, gunnery exercises with the Army and the RAF, and so on. So, the type of aircraft they flew there were the Seafire, the Mosquito, and the Harvard, and a Tiger Moth, but basically Seafire and Mosquitoes were used for unit, or the Martinet for target towing, which tow targets for the Army. So that Fleet Requirements Unit really gave me a lot of experience on the Mosquito before I joined 801 with the Sea Hornets.
What impressions did you get of the Mosquito?
What
impressions do you have of the Mosquito as an aircraft?
The aircraft Mosquito, superb. One of the most enjoyable aircraft I've ever flown. Heavy, fast, but and a lot of work to fly, but nice, a nice aircraft. The Hornet beat it hands down, of course, because it was a similar aircraft, but so much lighter and single seat.
Where did you join the Hornet squadron?
When did I join?
And where?
I joined the Hornet squadron... Well, it must have been before I joined these. Sea Hornet, here we are. Mosquitoes there. fish. Yeah, joined 801 Squadron July 49. July 49 in HMS Implacable.
And what was the Hornet like to fly?
What was the
Hornet like to fly?
Beautiful. In fact, if I remember rightly, a lot of naval pilots say it's the best fighter they've ever flown. It was superb to fly, really was.
Did it handle well?
Beautifully. It was one of the easiest and nicest, and you felt part of it. The power, of course, you've got two Rolls-Royce engines. There's a Spit only had one. And it went like a rocket. It was superb.
Did it have any vices?
Yes, I suppose so. I, on my deck landing on the Sea Hornet, on one occasion, an oleo collapsed. And that was because we converted to the American system of deck landing. The English system was quite simple. You came in on a designated approach, controlled approach, and you came down to the deck on 3 points. And the batsman put you down on 3 points. The American system, you came in about 10 or 15 or 20 foot high, and you cut, the batsman cut your engines, and you, your nose dropped, and you pulled back and picked up a wire. That entailed very much increase of vertical speed down. And British oleos tended to collapse, whereas the Americans were designed for a much higher rate. And when we started with the American system, we had quite a lot of oleos collapsed. I had one certainly on the Implacable. So that was really the only thing wrong with it. But it was a perfect aircraft for deck landing because you could see things like the Sea Fury and the Sea Fire. You couldn't see. You had to do a very curved approach. And if you're doing a curve in an aircraft, then you're pretty near stalling speed when you're at deck landing speed. So you have to be very, very careful while you concentrate how you get down or what speed you come in at. So speed control was absolutely vital in those sort of aircraft. With the Hornet, you could see perfectly. And you come in straight if you wanted. We never did, but you could do if you wanted to. It's ideal for radar blind approaches, radar controlled blind approaches, which of course came much later. The fleet arm at the end of the war was still fly by your pants. There were very few instruments, or radar instruments, or navigation instruments that told you exactly where you were. You had to do your own navigation on your knee. No mucking around.
And which carrier were you operating from?
What?
Which carrier?
That was Implacable. And the Korea was a glory and ocean.
And what was Implacable like as a... What was Implacable like as a...
Implacable, my memory of Implacable was a fleet carrier. It was easy to get lost on. It was a big carrier, it was a big ship, Implacable. The fleet carriers were much bigger than the... The following carriers like Theseus, Ocean, Glory, those carriers were much smaller and much easier to get yourself around and get a cabin in. I mean, in Glory at one time, as a senior pilot, I had a cabin underneath the flight deck, which was all right, so long as they weren't flying. But also it was very hot. We had a little bit of air conditioning, I suppose, in those days.
What type of things were you doing with 801? Were you exercising?
What?
With 801, what type of flying were you doing?
What type of flying?
With 801.
801? Oh, 801.
Sorry, 804.
Oh, this one, yeah. 801.
Sorry, was it 801, the Sea Hornets? What were you doing with the Sea Hornets? Were you exercising with them?
801 was that one, wasn't it? Sea Hornet, here we are. Deck landing practice, formation, deck landing, air test, night flying, undercarriage test. The adults are training for deck landings there. Slope flying, aerobatics, aerobatic slope flying formation, aero slope flying, adults. Single engine landings at Tangmere. Air tests, practice landers again. Tangmere to Lee, paired IF, you do instrument flying control. Flight drill, weather, feathering, single engine. Second familiar, single engine flying. Slow flying, formation, aerobatics. Drill, formation. Flight drill, oxygen climb, strike escort, flight drill. You do sort of things like, if weather's bad, you do a takeoff and a snake climb. They call it snake climb. The leader tells you what heading he is and when he's doing it, so that the following, they add 10 seconds and then do the same, and then you all come out the top the same. Snake at a climb.
Did you do any air displays?
Do I?
Did you do any air displays with the team when you were flying Sea Hornets?
Sorry, I'm not here.
Did you do any air displays? Were you flying with the team?
Oh, yeah, a lot of air displays, especially with the Hornet in later life and the Seahawk. More with the Seahawks than the Sea Fury. I didn't do very much with the Sea Fury. This is all. Formation errors, just trying to find the seat.